Good day. This is Pastor Chip Anderson of Christ Presbyterian Church in the Hill. And today's sermon is for the service of worship, instruction, and fellowship of CPC in the Hill for this Sunday, June 27th, 2021. Today, our text is Romans 9 through 21. The wholly different third way, the house churches in Rome. Let us return to the beginning of Romans. Paul's call to apostleship specifically is to bring about the obedience of faith among all the Gentiles, all the nations, all the ethne. That is Romans 1:5. That big therefore in Romans 12:1 is like a big, long inhale, exhale, after deeply and with painstaking detail, harnessing all the Greco-Roman tools of rhetoric, Paul masterfully has made the case that all have sinned, Jews and Gentiles, Jews and Greeks, all deserve the wrath of God, Jews and Gentiles, Jews and Greeks. And God's revelation of the gospel is for all who believe. Now inhale, exhale, therefore, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship, 12:1. Then Paul makes a reference to the grace given to me, to Paul, 12:3. And then he instructs on how the presenting of our bodies is to be done. By the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. There is no doubt the reference to the grace, this grace given to me, given to Paul, is that grace received to bring about the obedience of faith among all the nations. For we read in Romans 1:5, we, most likely an editorial we, meaning I have received grace, namely apostleship, to bring about the obedience of faith for the sake of his name among all the nations, all ethne. This leads me to conclude that Paul is undoubtedly turning to direct instructions to do just that. That is, to bring about the obedience of faith among all the ethne, all nations. And I do say that means both Israel and Gentile, all nations. And this means a church behaving like God's new family, composed of elite Greeks, barbarians, Jews, educated and uneducated, all illustrated and demonstrated by habits, attitudes, and individual conduct in corporate church life, and in their relationships with those outside the church, a third way, something that is neither Jew nor Greek, per se. One of the earliest nicknames given to the church was that phrase, third way. No doubt this is somewhat built on the reference given to the church early on, simply the way. Being referred to as the third way started showing up in about the second century and persisted for about 200 years of church history until it began to go out of fashion when Emperor Constantine incorporated the church into the empire and separated their gatherings from houses into separate buildings. At a time in American history, we are living in what I call the choose sides, you're either agree with us or you're not one of us eras. Choose sides, you either agree with us or you're not one of us eras. No doubt this is the case. No one on the Christian side of this is asking the most relevant question. Are we of the world or are we not of the world? Are we in the world but not of the world? Are we for the world and against the world at the same time? Yeah, I ask the question in a few different ways, but you get the question. So are we, the church, local churches, the third way of our time? What is different about us? What makes us more than a social, another social group? What makes us, yes, even a local church, a revelation of goodness of the gospel, the good news of the gospel? Are we that third way? Someone once wrote in the second century about the church being a third way. This is what he said. For Christians cannot be distinguished from the rest of the human race by country or language or custom. They do not live in cities of their own. They do not use a particular form of speech. They do not follow an eccentric manner of life. They live in their own countries, but as aliens. They have a share in everything as citizens and endure everything as foreigners. Every foreign land is their fatherland, and yet for them every fatherland is a foreign land. So, back to Paul. He has established the obedience of faith needed to be real among the house churches in Rome. Namely, each of us ought not to think more highly than we ought to think. Why? Because we are one body, members of one another. Now, in the remaining portion of Romans 12, this will, as if in rapid fire, set out this one body, members of one another, and what it looks like and behaves like. There seems to be actions that are toward each other in the congregation, the house churches in Rome, and some actions that are directed outward toward those outside the house churches, outsiders, the non-churched, the unsaved, the unredeemed. While these two sets of actions bleed into one another, there seems a grammatical and linguistic hint. This is twofold, inward and outward. And it's there for us to hear. We'll deal with that first, but let's listen to these verses. First, Romans 12, 9-13, toward each other among the house churches in Rome. Let us be genuine, abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good, love one another with brotherly affection, outdo one another in showing honor. Do not be slothful in zeal, but fervent in spirit, serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer. Verse 13, contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show hospitality. Then we have verses 14 through 21 toward those outside the church. Now, mind you, these all bleed together inside outside, but it's overall toward those outside the church. Verse 14, bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to what is honorable in the sight of all. Verse 18, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. Verse 20, to the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Verse 21, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Paul starts out with, abhor what is evil, hold fast what is good. And he ends with, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Before we get going on the contents of our text this morning, let me pause to give at least two reasons why there seems to be an inward-outward set of instructions here. First, the content seems directed that way. While one can indeed apply verses 14 through 27 to fellow Christians, inasmuch as one can apply love your enemies, or if someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn and let them slap you on the left cheek. It seems, though, that persecutors are outside the congregation, and the live peaceably with all is a dead giveaway that Paul has broadened his view beyond the household churches. Now, we turn to the second reason, and it is an obvious grammatical reason found in the big pun, namely the use of dikeo, persecute, pursue, in verses 13 and 14, seek, to show, intentionally pursue, verse 13, and in verse 14, persecute. The point at which Paul makes the subtle turn right here. If I could show you a picture of the text, I could circle the words and it would be plain as day. The word dioko can and is often the word used to indicate persecution of Christians, the church even of Jesus in the Gospels. Its simple root idea is pursue, seek, but carries a strong, more intentional nuance. My translation, intentionally pursue, in verse 13, intentionally pursue hospitality, that Paul would use the same word to describe those who would bring harm to the church and to describe the church's call to hospitality, literally the love of the stranger, in their homes, or at least a minimum at the designated home of the gathered church, is both ironic and instructive. Ironic because the church is called to use their households as a place of intentional hospitality, the loving of the stranger. Despite that there are those hostile in persecuting, there's that word again, the church. In fact, this is how we win our persecutors. Exercising the same hospitality God has shown in Christ Jesus, making enemies into friends and family, instructive because this is how the church does good. Verse 9b. Later at the end of the chapter, Paul is going to command us, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Verse 22. This is a gathered church thing, not simply an individual Christian thing. It is through the gathered church that evil is overcome. This is how we are not overcome by evil. That is, overcoming evil by doing good, back to intentionally pursuing hospitality. So how that works in this context. See how that works in this context. See how important the gathered church is. Okay. Now that I've gotten ahead of myself, you see in verses 9 through 13, Paul instructs the church to be the church toward one another. And then in verses 14 through 21, Paul instructs the church to be the church toward the world, a world that seeks to persecute the church and a world that is swimming in neighbor hate and distrust and retaliation. The instructions here in verses 13 through 21 are set in a way to be read like rapid fire, snappy until the end, where they are commanded not to take any posture or action or vengeance or retaliation. Let's read it the way Paul wrote it, without verse and number. Let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not be slothful in zeal, but fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in tribulation. Be consistent in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints. Seek to show hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and curse not. Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep, live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink, for by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Now, allow me to do some Greek here. There are verbs missing and participles with no antecedent verb. Just lots of nouns and adjectives and a few participles. But they serve a purpose for Paul in writing this way. Here we go. This is more my translation, if you will, but pretty close to word for word. The love, genuine. Abhor the evil. Hold fast the good. The familiar, unto affection, unto one another family. Love. The honor, one another honoring. The earnestness, not lazy. The spirit, jealously. The Lord serving. The hope, rejoicing. The suffering patiently, the praying consistently, the needs of the saints. You can see how this is directed toward the house churches in Rome. The needs of the saints contribute. The hospitality pursue. Let us take this a little at a time now. The instructions directed inward among the church community in Rome first. Let love be genuine, abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. I think we could read this, let love be genuine. How is this done? By abhorring evil and holding fast to good. This makes sense of the lack of verbs and the participles that follow the first instruction to let love be genuine. So the abhor what is evil and the hold fast of what is good is how to let love be genuine. Love one another with brotherly affection. The idea of brotherly is more in line with family, as in the brotherly relationships in a family or in an intimate relationship. And we should own the language. Don't contemporize it to say love one another with brotherly and sisterly affection, because that isn't what it meant. For the whole of that fellowship, attendance at that table, women, slaves, children, it would have been an honor to be called the love of the brethren. The brethren. This would have given new meaning to the language. Plus, Paul is doing a wordplay. To the brethren, unto one another, philostorgos. I know, that's Greek. I'm sorry. That just means the mutual love of parents and children and wives and husbands. Familiar love. Familiar love. In other words, the friendly and family-like love reserved for males of the household or community, not shared with all who are among the household churches, now are shared among the household churches in Rome. This would have had an equalizing effect. Next, outdo one another in showing honor. Honor was selective in that society. Here, Paul is equally distributing honor to one another in the house churches in Rome. I like the ESV, outdo, and we should take it that way, in that no one should be left behind when it comes to honor. The idea is to take the lead, so be the initiative, and more literally, make it appear. Intentionally make honor appear to one another. A very fair reading of Paul's words here. Be not slothful in zeal. Be fervent in spirit, serve the Lord. The next set of rapid-fire instructions can be read together. In earnest, intention. Do not be lax in these things. Be fervent, intentional, as you serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in tribulation. Be constant in prayer. This drives us back to the theology Paul has provided in Romans 1 through 11. All hope, tribulation, suffering, prayer has been in the mix in Romans 1 through 11. What Paul seems to be highlighting or driving at in including these is the situation among the house churches of Rome and the cultural and social condition of their Greco-Roman world isn't aligned with the gospel. It is the opposite, and that will cause conflict, tension, and suffering. So be rejoicing in the hope that is ours and will be manifest in time. Be patient. Show it by being patient amid the trials, tensions, and suffering that comes from the rejoicing and the hope of the gospel. Be consistent in prayer, even when we don't know what to pray for. Soon in chapter 15, Paul will tell us to be in prayer together, to strive together in prayer for Paul as he ministers and carries out his apostolic call to the ethne, to the nations. Interesting. Praying that Paul has divine help in being obligated to the elite Greek, the barbarian, the Jew, the educated, and uneducated, perhaps even praying for those opposite and unequal to themselves consistently. Contribute to the needs of the saints. The whole sermon could be done here, but I'm going to refrain from doing that. Contribute to the needs of the saints. The word here is koinoneo, the needs of the saints. You can hear the word koinonia, fellowship here. Fellowship, the needs of the saints. This is the common word for having fellowship. A gathered church kind of fellowship. Acts 2:42. Although contribute is perfectly good English action word to use here, I use it in my own translation. We cannot escape that Paul harnesses a word that describes the gathered church, koinonia, a gathered fellowship, sharing, having all things in common church. This is how the church in Acts and the early church, up to AD 150 at least, met the needs of the saints as they gathered for a meal. That's the supper, folks. All got to eat, the poor and the wealthy, the widow and the orphan, the children, wives, slaves, and men, the haves and the have-nots. And that's actually what I think is being corrected in 1 Corinthians 10 through 11. The gathered church is the locus of meeting the needs of the saints. Christians, enemies, strangers, unequals now become family, whom you must remember is a gathering of strangers and unequals of all types, from the marginally unwanted to the wealthy and sociably acceptable. The socially unacceptable. They together meet the needs of others because they were housed together as new family, as a gathered church, with a meal, if you haven't caught that yet. Seek to show hospitality. Seek, pursue, in a second, in the next verse, this word will be rendered persecute. You can see that word place here in Greek. The love of strangers, pursuing. Bless those who pursue. That's the idea. There is a slight linguistical change that appears here in the final in-house set of instructions. From a consistent use of the dative, you don't even have to know that what that is, just the way things are written, what part of language it is, to the brethren, to honor, to earnestness, to spirit, to the Lord, to hope, to tribulation, to prayer, to the needs, and then all of a sudden, the hospitality. Here in the last one, Paul words order of the previous instructional phrases, but changes from the dative to the accusative. No big deal, perhaps, but could well signal this whole set of instructions is hospitality. So now we take the turn to be church to outsiders. And that is the cultural rub, verses 14 through 21. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and curse them not. It would have been unimaginable, as it is today, to bless those who persecute you for anything, let alone being a Christian. Again, for sure, Paul is making a wordplay here between hospitality, the love of strangers, caring for people, welcoming people, strangers, into one's house, versus those who would persecute the house churches in Rome, taking the plural you as plural, a number, the house churches in Rome. Everything about the nature of the gospel, about that table, about that house church is contrary to the social and cultural attitudes and habits of that day. Here's the rub. Not only did the new relationships offend their neighbors, the equalizing of slaves, women, and children in terms of honor and dignity and humanness, there was the little problem of only worshiping one God and making that treasonous criminal who hung on a cross equal to God, in fact proclaiming him Lord and God. This is a problem. You see, the Christians, the house churches in Rome, worshiped their God and honored Jesus as God. But out in the community and over at the neighbor's supper table, these Christians would not recognize and worship their gods. You see, the big problem was just that. While everyone and anyone in the Roman world would have worshiped their own God and gods, they would still, when necessary, honor their neighbor's gods, their co-workers' gods, their family gods, their community gods, and of course, honor Caesar. Nope, couldn't do that as Christians, as church, wouldn't do that, or else they'd not be Christians, nor would they be recognized as baptized members of the household fellowship. This isn't just any old persecuting. We flatten persecuting to anyone who is angry at us or won't let us do Christian things or won't let us do what we want. Just adding that we're Christians to that list isn't persecution. This is when we act as the church, not just as a Christian, but a local church of believers, acting like church in the community, of course, as both individuals and as a group, a congregation. Then we turn, rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. Despite how we are treated, this is what we do with those in our neighborhood, our extended family, our co-workers, the people outside of our small band of believers meeting in that house church in Rome. We participate in the outsiders' joys and that we weep with them when there is tragedy. Don't hyper-slice this with questions like, what if they are rejoicing in something to do with false gods and pagan worship or worshiping because they are paying for the consequences of their sins? Oh, please, you already know the answer to those type of questions. Rejoicing and weeping. Be able to not judge and enter into the joys of life and the cruelty of life. People did not do that without something to gain for themselves. Here, the Christian community just rejoices and weeps without any patronage or gain or leverage. That's what this context suggests. This is what made church different. If this isn't plain to you, the next set of instructions will affirm this. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. I do take these three together, mostly because they can be, and they are about interrelationships. First, the idea of harmony here is actually the phrase "the same thinking," or as used elsewhere by Paul, "the same mind to one another." Obviously not the same mind toward false gods and pagan temple worship, or even same mind toward the typical pagan rituals as a supper meal. Having the same mind, which makes the ESV translation "live in harmony" perfectly suitable, means to have a certain mind, which is then described in the following set of instructions. What does it mean to have the same mind? To live in harmony, more literally, toward others, which has the wrong resulting consequence not intended by Paul. What does it mean to have the same mind? A same mind. Don't be haughty. Again, some of you don't think, again, same as don't think more highly of yourselves than you ought to think. And then Paul gives a cultural and social mapping twist. But associate with the lowly. There is no reason to make this set of instruction two separate sentences, as most translations do. So listen as one sentence. The same toward one another thinking, not the arrogant thinking. Okay, fair enough. Let's iron that word order out in English, okay? The same thinking toward one another, not the arrogant thinking, but the lowly associate. You can see how this is being church among outsiders. This is gospel, living in association that does not affirm or conform. Here we go, that Romans 12:2 thing. Not conforming to the social mapping of Roman culture and society. And this brings us back to not appearing wise, i.e. cultural thinking, as I take this particular word, which is similar to the previous thinking word that Paul uses, not appearing similar to the cultural way of thinking of yourselves. Not appearing similar to the cultural way of thinking of yourselves. Without some form of patronage, no one would just hang with the lowly in those days. Here, Paul is wanting the local church to be church even out in the public sphere, doing the the opposite of what was done in those days. One would only be among or associated with the lowly if it benefited it in some way. Don't have this thinking. I believe Paul is driving at that. Oh, by the way, such a reference to the lowly should point out that it was assumed by the New Testament writers that the church would be associated with the lowly, both in among the table and out in the public sphere. Okay, now as we turn to the remaining verse, I will take verses 17 through 20 as one thought. Though I think interpersonal social mapping is totally in the background of this section, 14 through 20 is now specifically about the retaliatory and vengeful social habits and attitudes that are front and center in Paul's day. In Calvin's book, The Singer, it's a beautiful book, it defines vengeance and mercy in light of the cross that I think is very relevant to our text here. He defines, ready? Vengeance, and then he gives the meaning. Vengeance. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, a fair and rapid way to a sightless, toothless world. Mercy, then he defines it. Mercy, the infrequent art of turning thumbs up on an old antagonist at the end of one's rapier, at the end of one's sword. One of the quickly learned consequences or application for a changed life that Jesus' death on the cross was to not take vengeance into one's own hands. And the cross, and with Jesus hanging right there, God, as if he God, shouted, "This is how violence and vengeance stops. If you don't get this, you don't understand the power of the cross. You have misunderstood the gospel." For the direct trajectory, application of the cross according to Jesus, and the New Testament writers is that a Christian is to refrain from vengeance in any form and to turn away from any form of retaliatory violence upon other human beings, always and ever. No doubt this is the reference, the cultural retaliation and vengeance in verse 17. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to what is honorable in the sight of all. Historian Jerry Toner says of Roman non-elite people, the barbarian, Jew, and the uneducated, most of them see their neighbors as competitors, not comrades in the harsh reality of scarce resources. To have nothing is to be nothing in the Roman world. Theirs was a culture where people struggled to look down on their neighbors with something of the same judgment that the elite downed on them. So, Paul is calling the house churches to live in such a way among outsiders that it is contrary, countercultural. Bless those who persecute, and don't curse them. Rejoice and weep with those who are their competitor neighbors. Associate with those lower than themselves with nothing to gain in the social mapping of their day. And now, don't participate in the retaliatory and vengeful attitudes and habits that mark much of their daily existence there on the west bank of the Tiber River on the outskirts of Rome. And this won't be easy. And that is why Paul says in verse 18, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. It is impossible to live peaceably with all. There's that all again. To live peaceably with all, the elite Greek, the barbarian, the Jew, the educated, and the uneducated. Impossible all the time, everywhere, at all moments and every occasion. But as far as it depends on you, the church, live peaceably with all. Evaluate every situation and take responsibility to be the one who brings peace among all those concerned. Whatever is possible, whenever it's possible to make peace, that is the Christian's responsibility. That is the posture of the local church. Verse 19 isn't a thumping verse. You know what a thumping verse is. It's that verse we Christians like to pull out to thump others who don't give us our way, honor us as we think we should be honored, grant us what we think is our due, or else God will get you. He will make you pay. Of course, there are many forms of this, and you know them. You all know them. This isn't for you to leverage on others. And if you do, then you are not keeping all the instructions that Paul has written before, and starting in verse 3. So here's verse 19. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. This is a lean to God's sovereignty and learn to trust Him verse. A lean into God's sovereignty and trust Him verse. Learn to trust Him verse. If you quote to boast of your faith in God, if you quote this to kind of boast about your faith in God, then you are not using it correctly. You are thumping it and boasting. This is thinking more highly of yourself than you ought to think. This verse is referred to by Tertullian in his first book on patience, the first Christian book ever. What is interesting is that it is not so much that God will take vengeance out on those who offend or harm us, but that, as Tertullian points out, God will reward our patience. Do not return evil for evil, but God, they are in the wrong and I am innocent. But bless them might get them the wrong impression about us. I hate those words we too often see pop up on Facebook. Don't mistake my kindness for weakness. I'll still... And you could fill in the blank, and you know what follows. Something about punching, thumping, kicking, and all sorts of violence antithetical to being a Christian. This is from Christians. Heaven help us. Any and all the forms of this false doctrine takes is the complete opposite of the Christian teaching that is for us. Period. End of discussion. In other words, when you are loving your enemy, blessing those that persecute you, rejoicing with your pagan, ungodly neighbors, when you are weeping with those that worship multiple gods, when you are trying and maybe not succeeding, but trying nonetheless to be the agent of peace, I will take care, Paul is saying, God will take care of all that can and will likely go wrong and bring harm to you. And perhaps your church, your household of believers, I, Paul, saying God, will take care of that. Verse 19 and 20 go together. On the one hand, never take vengeance. God can be trusted to bring justice. And on the other hand, do the opposite of what is expected by the culture and the social mapping. Take great concern for your enemy. Beloved, never avenge yourself, verse 19, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Verse 20, to the contrary, here's that other side of it. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. And for by doing so, you will keep burning coals on his head. Now verse 20 is way too often taken in a retaliatory way. I feed and give drink to my enemy, then God will judge them and heap burning coals on their heads. If we take it that way, and if we feed and drink to our enemy so that their heads would be burning, then that's not love, and certainly 180 degrees away from what the whole context has been suggesting. While it be true, this has been a difficult verse to interpret. The surrounding company of clear text cannot allow us to use this proverb as a means to take vengeance. This probably simply means take care of the needs of your enemy and let God take care of you and whatever judgment is appropriate for your enemy. Finally, we haven't gotten the instructions yet, nor what is ultimately behind them. If we haven't gotten it from 3 all the way down to 19, Paul concludes, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Do good. Be church in your community, in your neighborhood. Good overcomes evil, but God will. And we can list, we often say, but God, what about? And we can list all the what-ifs and what-abouts. Simply put, this is the way of God in the world, in your community, in your neighborhood. Don't be overcome by evil. This is the word used of Jesus having victory over the grave, over the world, the victory given to those who live by faith. That is, remain faithful to Jesus no matter what. The same victory the saints in the visions of the book of Revelation conquer with, they conquer all the evil that comes their way. Using the language of this chapter, don't let the world and its ways and habits and culture and social mapping overcome you. The house churches in Rome, but overcome all this evil, whatever it stops. Whether it stops or gets worse, and it will probably get worse, by being the church in the world around you, in your neighborhood, in your community. I'm sorry, I'm just unable to direct this to the individual Christian apart from the local church. Paul does not do this. This is why it is so important for the church to get the gospel that Paul preaches right. And I know some don't like to hear it, but too bad, it's in the New Testament. And it is an element of the gospel. Get the gospel right and its social implications, especially its social mapping implications. This is the transformed mind. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed in mind. The not conforming to this age and being transformed by the renewing of our imaginations, Romans 12, 9 through 21, is the foundation and impulse for the imagination we are to have as a church. The more I learned about the social and cultural location of New Testament times, the more I become and am becoming dreadfully aware we are in our own time, vastly becoming more and more similar to that Greco-Roman world of Paul and the apostles in which they lived out the gospel. While the small band of Christians meeting at table in the back of workshops and fire-prone apartments and in supper rooms of small homes and a few of the affluent, mostly these Christians carry on their Roman daily lives, yet in a wholly different way that allowed God to turn the world upside down. This is clearly in Paul's instruction to the house churches in Rome. Not to take vengeance or be retaliatory in any way to anyone who sought to do them harm. A very difficult thing to do in a culture that strived off of vengeance and the taking of advantage of their neighbors, not just among the elite, but also among the poor populations where resources were scarce. The more I study this, the more our current social and cultural location is mirroring Rome, yet the local church needs to be a third way. Somehow wholly different. Oz Guinness once wrote, "The world watches us to see whether we are followers of the way of Jesus or of an idolatry." Excuse me, it is idolatry. Or an ideology. To follow the way of him who called us to love our enemies and do good to those who hate us, as Jesus did. We have to take the hate and hurt into ourselves. That's what he wrote. The third way makes demands on the church, marked by lives transformed by Christ. There needs to be a true sense of the not of this world emanating from us, a sense of vocation and mission. Live this as third way. Lived this as third way will provoke outsiders to ask, what do they have that I don't? Challenging, of course, but make no mistake, the third way is not simply a program. It is the life of the church. We will need to be seen as third wayers, else we have nothing to offer the world that it does not already have. May God add his blessing to this word and to my interpretation of it, so that we might be edified to be the church among ourselves and to this world. Amen.